We're really excited about today. My name is Derek Wilson, and I am a teacher. I'm the chair of the Bible department at Greater Atlanta Christian School in Atlanta, Georgia. And this is Dusty, and Dusty is a preacher at campus. At Campus Church of Christ in Atlanta. It's a church in Norcross, Georgia. Just to give you an idea, kind of our context, Dusty also teaches Bible at GAC, so our school. The school is about 2,000 K through 12. It's the second largest private school in Georgia. And our high school is about 800 kids. And so the thing I love about this high school is it's incredibly diverse for a private school in Atlanta. So it's diverse, fairly diverse ethnically. It's fairly diverse socioeconomically. It's kind of more on the upper class side, but it's still fairly diverse, and it's also diverse religiously, which is my favorite part. We were talking about this before. I think maybe 30% of our school would identify as Christians that are active in a church somewhere. And then 30% are Christians and that they go to church a couple times a year. And then I would say 30% are totally secular, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu,
Atheist
openly, and so it's an amazing place. We have a bunch of Chinese at our school from China. I get the joy of teaching them, and it's awesome. I think my favorite moment is just to show you the cultural diversity. I was talking to them. We're talking about the image of God, and I was like, everybody's made in the image of God. This is why you can't murder someone, because it's like murdering the image of God, or this is why you can't bully someone, and then I was like, this is why you can't look at like porn or something like that. And I was like, their hand shoots up in my Chinese kid. Like, Mr. Wilson, what is porn? And I was like, I'm trying to describe it real delicately, and it's not going through. They know what it is, right? But they don't know what it is in English, and so I'm trying to describe it, and then finally this girl in the back gets really frustrated. She's like, forget it, I will Google it. Our church is Campus Church of Christ, and it sits on GAC's campus, and so the church is set up also in a neighborhood that is, you could tell us a little bit more about the neighborhood probably.
You want me to start into the...
Yeah, go for it.
So the church is truly diverse. So every church says that they're diverse, right? And that means sometimes that you have 60-year-old white people and 65-year-old white people, right? this is truly, we haven't made it this way, it just is part of Atlanta and part of the community. There is great economic diversity. If you come into campus and sit down, you might sit next to a multimillionaire, or you might sit down next to a homeless person, and you probably cannot tell the difference between the two oftentimes. The school is very wealthy. The community is economically depressed. We're surrounded by about 7 or 8 hotels that are called homeless hotels. People kind of gravitate from one to the other. And then the diversity in Atlanta is just extreme. So we have within the church Vietnamese, Korean, Chinese, Hispanic, Black, white, young, old, very educated because of the school, uneducated, rich, poor. I love it. I love that. And so one of the things that we've talked about a lot since I've been there for 5 years is that the church is to be about breaking down barriers, not building barriers. And oftentimes, because the church is full of human beings, we tend to build barriers instead of tear them down. And we sort of like to take stances, which oftentimes is barrier building, rather than make movement toward people to try to redeem. And so here's my claim, and this is what Derek and I are going to talk about. We're going to try and lay out five things that you already know, but we'll try and flesh them out a little bit. My claim is that in a church that is extremely diverse, truly diverse, and therefore there is great beauty in that, and there's a lot of difficulty and challenge. Because when you walk into the room, you may see diversity, but when decisions are made and when practices are lived out, there is less diversity. Because one group of people tends to get to call the shots, right? We experience this in all walks of life, not just church. And my claim is that diversity is really difficult. Breaking down barriers is really hard. And the most difficult barrier in my church right now to break down is not black and white. It's not rich and poor. It's not Chinese and Hispanic. It's not educated and uneducated. It is generational, old and young. The young people don't want to have very much to do with you all. I'm looking at you, all of us except for Derek and these two in the front. And I'm not sure about the yellow sweatshirt. Can't tell. We're, the rest of us are all old. Right? I'm 44. That's not old to some of you, but it's old. It's old to my 18-year-old daughter.
It's old to me.
And to all of my students. It's old to Derek, who I hate. Young people don't want to have much to do with us. And they roll their eyes a lot at me when I teach seniors in Bible. And the older, honestly, don't want to have a lot to do with the younger. They say that they do, but there's not a lot of movement there. When they say that they do, my experience has been, I'm not throwing you into this category, but my experience has been, we sure want the younger to come along and do what we do and like what we like.
Yeah.
All right? And so we're just honestly acknowledging, man, this is hard. Like, it's just hard for human beings to get along. Remember when you first got married? And, oh, man, I got to share this space with a crazy person, right? And no one is to blame for this difficulty, and we are all to blame for this difficulty. We want to throw out, okay, here are five things that we've observed, we've wrestled with, we have been victorious in some of these and are totally failing in others, but we see the light. Like, we see, hey, that's where we want to be, and that's what we're trying to get to. Okay? Are you with me? Okay, so Hebrews chapter 10. Let me read this passage to you that I heard a whole lot from my mom when I was growing up. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. Whoever this Hebrew writer is, he or she, is writing to a community who's struggling to hold on to faith. And so the encouragement is a communal encouragement to hold on to faith. And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. So, okay, this is an encouragement text. It's more than that. It's an encouragement to be encouragers text. But guess how I thought about this passage growing up? This is an encouragement text, and it had a big, it was like pasted to a big hammer.
Right.
And I was hit in the head with it a lot growing up, right? This text is a good text to start with, and it is sort of symbolic of one of our chief struggles, and that is we're not generationally encouraging. All right, so we're going to start off simple. And that is the first, we're going to go back and forth. The first thing is, if you want to build bridges with the younger generation, make it your chief task to be the cheerleader for the younger generation. So I have a sixth grader who plays soccer. And she is not good at soccer. Don't tell her this if you ever meet her. She does not know that she is not good at soccer. She's not much of an athlete. Her mom doesn't know that. Crystal is my wife. Crystal doesn't know that she is not a good athlete either. And so we go to the soccer games, and every soccer game, Crystal says, I don't think Kate feels very well. She's not running right. And I want to say, that's how she runs, and that's how you run, right? And so we have this routine. We go out to the soccer game on Saturdays. You've been done this routine before, right? And here's the routine. A whole lot of out-of-shape adults carry something to the sideline. What is that something that they carry?
A chair.
A chair, right? Because they're not going to stand for an hour. They're going to sit for an hour. Some of them have umbrellas. They sit in a chair, and they all yell one thing over and over again to the children who are playing soccer. This is their cheer. What is that cheer?
Run.
All of us who are so out of shape, we're wheezing as we walked over and sat down in our chair, are yelling to those who are in really great shape and have been doing nothing but running the entire time. They've been running for an hour. We're yelling at them to run more, run faster, run longer, run harder. And I, every time I go out there, I'm a runner, I think, man, I want to see some of you people get up and run laps during halftime, right? This is what we call cheering, right? There's something that happens to us as we get older. This is what we call cheering, encouraging, screaming at our children to run harder and run faster. So maybe we need to take a step back and think about what does it mean to cheer on the younger generation? What does it look like? We have four children. Our oldest child really put us through the ringer a couple of years ago. And all of the judgments I made of bad parents just went out the window. I was so humbled and apologetic in my mind to all of the things that I thought about parents and who couldn't control their kids. Guess what? You can't control any of your kids. You just think that you're controlling them. And I went to one of my elders who I really respect and love and just said, hey, can I talk to you? And I said, I just need some advice. Here's what's going on. And we're barely hanging on to her. And we're just trying to stay in her life, you know. And we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or the next week. And I had an expectation of what he might say and some guidance that he would give and some advice. And he only said one thing to me. He actually got a little teary with me in his response. And he said, Dusty, does Emma know that you believe in her? That was it. That's it. Not like, hey, do these three things. Get drug testing for your house and put your foot down and make sure she knows all of the rules and make sure there are stern consequences. And I was ready for like, okay, what kind of boot camp shall we, you know, create? And he said, hey, does Emma know that you believe in her? And then, man, I started to cry because I knew the answer to that question. And he said, you know, you don't get to dictate her future, but I can tell you that if she doesn't know that you believe in her, all is lost. So this is your task. This is the only charge you gave me. You go make sure that she believes in you. You're going to have to leave the rest up to Emma and to God, but this is your job as her dad. You make sure, you pour into her, make sure she believes in you. I just wonder, we have really wonderful people in our church, young and old, but what would happen if everyone 40 and older made it their task to make sure that all of the youngers knew we believe in them above all else? This is what we're not trying to shape you in a certain way. We are, but this is our chief task. We're cheering you on. We believe in you. We believe in God in you. Right? Okay, so that's number one. Be cheerleaders of the younger generation. If you actually want to build a bridge between older and younger, if you want to embrace generational generosity. I'll just say one more thing. Have I taken 10 minutes?
Yeah, you're good.
I think that we olders, we moderns who are now working with postmodern children, that we need to take a really serious, long look at the value or the I'm trying to think of the opposite of value. Anybody?
Worthlessness?
Yeah, the worth or worthlessness of critique and confrontation. I just think, and maybe we're not all this way, I think that most of us grew up in a culture in which critique and confrontation were valued to a certain degree. Like, no one loves it, but we think that it has a valuable place and that it actually does something for people. And it is my claim that critique and confrontation is not very valuable. There are moments that we are forced into it, that we have to answer questions or be honest with people, but that it truly is almost always a last resort because of this fact. It doesn't work very well. It makes you feel good, because you got it out and you said what you thought. But if you'll just take I know some of you don't believe me on this, but if you'll just do a little inventory of how often that actually led to transformation. I'm not saying that it never does, but I think that it rarely does. This is not the way that we are shaped and transformed. We are more often shaped and transformed by the miraculous work of the Holy Spirit in our lives, because the Holy Spirit knows timing perfectly. And encouragement. It is encouragement. Knowing people that, here's what I know about that person. They are for me. They're for me even when I'm rotten. They're for me. Okay.
That's good.
That's so good. That's probably the best thing you're going to hear all day. Because now it's Derek's turn.
Yeah, it's all downhill from here. He believes in me, obviously.
Yeah.
Touche. I think one of the biggest kind of places that I run up against with older generations and this younger generation is the way that we view truth. And I think... If I could speak, so we have the modern generation, which is all of you, and then maybe us, right? And then the postmodern generation, which tends to be your children, your teenagers, and so on and so forth. These worlds that we grew up in are very, very different. With my 15-year-olds that I teach, the freshmen that I teach, they grew up in the era where 9/11 is a historical event. Not something they lived through. They grew up in an event. How many of you owned a passport as a teenager? Two. If I were to ask my class, I would say probably 90% of them have a passport. We live in an era, I think one of the greatest transformational forces in this postmodern era has been globalization. That the world is much, much smaller than it used to be. And that we are much, much more connected than we used to be. I'm about to get on a plane to go to China with 20 kids. And they're 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds. And they will go to China. I have a boy in my class at 16 that will live in China this summer to work at an orphanage. I don't want to speak for your generation, but that sounds, I think, would be absurd in the 70s and 60s. For sure with China, right? But obviously other places, right? And so this world is very, very different. And I think this globalization is radically shifting our view on truth. And some of that is from reader response and French philosophers and all this kind of movement and philosophy. But I think the biggest shift on this truth is that it's globalization, is that our kids are coming into contact more and more with opposing worldviews and differing worldviews than has ever happened before. That they get on the internet and they see hundreds of different worldviews. They go to school, and it's not like they're just going to school with these group that believes exactly what I believe and exactly how I feel, but they're hearing all these things and they're talking to their buddies and they're like, Jack doesn't believe in God, but Jack's a really good person, right? Or my friend Muhammad is Muslim, but he's a really good person too. Like, what makes my truth more valuable than their truth, right? And this is something that I think is having to be asked at a very young age that, and I don't want to speak for your generation, but that I don't think had to be asked that often. At an older generation. And so our kids are wrestling with doubt very much incredible ways. And I think for the older generation, so modernism values certainty. It's these philosophers, it's if then, right? It's logic is king. We can reason our ways to know God, to know the truth. And for this generation, postmodernism, doubt is a language and a sea that they live in. It is a world that they are constantly floating in. And I think for modernism, that is a scary thing. But for them, it is just is. And I think the cross demands that we start to view doubt differently. You look at Jesus on the cross, right? He's standing there, right? And all of his disciples have put all their hope into this person, that he's going to bring the kingdom of God. Boy, that they don't understand who or what he is, but that he's the Messiah. He's going to kick the Romans out. He's going to reestablish the rule of Israel here and now. He's going to do this. And then they get to Friday, and they look up, and they see this Messiah naked and dying and being tortured to death on a cross. Talk about radical doubt that comes over you. We want to jump to Sunday, but I really think that in a lot of ways this generation is in Saturday, right? Where we're asking, where is God? And in fact, that is the exact words that come out of Jesus' mouth on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? And so instead of being afraid of doubt, we should see doubt as the integral part of the process. That doubt is a part of the crucifixion. I mean, all of these disciples doubt. They flee. They run. And if you look through it even more, you see it. You see Thomas, right? He says, I won't believe until what? I see the hands, right? And then here's the crazy part, though. In John, when you reread John, read it at the end, John 20, when it goes to this, he's made the statement, I don't believe in the resurrection. Jesus is not alive. These are statements he is making. And then you look, and they're in this room, and it says they were all eating and being together, and it mentions Thomas. Thomas doesn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus, and he still has fellowship with these people. That doubt is not, and we got to take the boogeyman out of doubt. This is what they're living in, is this. And so if we see doubt as this, whoa, this is a terrible thing, this is a scary thing, then our generation, they will run away from that because they need space to ask questions. In the same way Jesus asked God, where are you? If the Son of God can ask God, where are you? Then surely we can allow our teenagers and 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds to ask the same questions and not be afraid. And I look at this. I mean, you even look at Israel. The name of Israel is, in Hebrew, did anybody know? It's he who wrestles with God. That it's a nation full of God wrestlers. And I think that's what this postmodern is. It's God wrestlers. It's people that are grappling with the faith. They haven't thrown faith out. In a lot of ways, when I see my teenagers, they are very spiritual people. But they don't know what it looks like. And they're trying to figure it out. Because at a very early age, they're seeing all these different worldviews. So what is it? What is it? And I think a lot of times, I like to think about when I think about the crucifixion, I think about Judas and Peter. So you got Judas, right? Who, I think Judas is a good person, actually. That might be terribly heretical, but I think he is. I think he misunderstands who Jesus is. I think he sees Jesus as this king that's going to kick the Romans out. And so he goes to the priest, and he sees Jesus, and Jesus isn't doing anything. He rides into Jerusalem on a what, donkey? And he has women and children singing songs and waving palm branches. This is not a military force. But he believes he is the Son of God. He believes he is this divine Messiah. And so he wants Jesus to move. And so what does he do? He starts to try to force his hand. And think about it, really. Afterwards, what does Judas do? He goes and hangs himself, right? That is not a person that's bad. That is a person that's deeply, deeply troubled by their actions. And then you look at it, so Judas betrays Peter and hangs himself. And then you have Peter, who also betrays Jesus, and in fact denies Jesus. And if you read Luke, it says after Jesus, Peter's the third denial, Jesus looks him in the eyes. He's not only denying Jesus, he's denying Jesus within earshot as Jesus is being flogged. And he says, he raises his curse, I don't bleepin' know the man. Right? This is what he says. And Jesus looks at him as he's being beaten. And then you look at where they end up, right? Both have doubts about who Jesus is. Both are questioning about who Jesus is. And you have one ends up hanging from a tree and the other ends up the leader of the church. And I'm afraid what happens, the message our students get is that doubt is a bad thing. That modernism is focused around certainty. That is a core of modernism, is that truth is 100%. You can figure it out if you try hard enough. And this is it. And postmodernism says, oh, no, there's a lot of doubts, a lot of worldviews, and a lot of things. And what we're doing is we're hanging our kids on this doubt, just like Judas. And that maybe if we give grace, and we give grace to them to engage in these questions. So I think some tips. All right. First of all, it starts with our own journey. I always say you can't go anywhere that you're not leading people yourself. It starts with us in the older generation asking tough questions and wrestling with these doubts. And it's great because a lot of you already have. But I think it's allowing us to have questions, allowing us to be God wrestlers. And then when students come and when teenagers come and they express doubt, to not be shocked, but also to not too quickly answer that question. Because for them, they're okay with the journey. It's the moderns that aren't okay with the journey. They're okay with the doubts and the questions and figuring it out. The moderns are not. We want to solve it, and we want to get it. And so what we end up doing actually is short-circuiting faith for a lot of our teenagers. Faith is a muscle that, if not flexed, it atrophies. And so what it is returning back with questions and asking, and then eventually helping them arrive at some place with faith. I have a student that his parent, he loves God. He does. But when he was 15, he started reading the Gospels really seriously. And if you read Matthew and Luke very seriously, what you soon find out is that Matthew and Luke's birth narratives aren't the same, and they're fairly different, right? That in one, Matthew, Jesus goes to Egypt, and Luke, he's born in a manger. There's shepherds, and then in Matthew, there's magi, and then there's Herod in Matthew, but there's no Herod in Luke, and then there's John the Baptist's birth in Luke, and then he's like, what do I do with this? And he goes to his mom and dad, and he's like, Mom, Dad, like, this is a guy that genuinely loves God. He wants to know. He's like, what is going on? I don't know if I can trust this. And his parents are like, there's differences? They have no idea, right? Which sends him more. He's like, whoa, what am I doing? But his parents, I think, made the best move. What they said is, look, this bothers us too. Let's go on this journey together. And hey, there's some books. Let's read some books together. Let's ask questions. They don't tell him, hey, look, just have faith, get over it, kind of thing. It was just short. They don't say, it doesn't matter. You know, they don't sweep it to the side. They send them to me to come talk through this. But it's not like they're just kicking him out the door. They're like, we want to know. Go talk to Mr. Wilson, see what he says, and then come back, right? And so I come back, I'm like, Connor, what do you think about this? This. Think about this. Go home, talk to your parents. And so we meet for a period, and his parents enter on into this journey. I think doubt and struggles, what we see in chapel, so we run chapel at GAC, and what we see at chapel is the chapels that connect with, and again, we have a very non-Christian demographic. The chapels that connect, they're people that are openly struggling with their doubts and struggles. Chapel, when I lost a baby, then you could just hear through the air come out of it. When I got so addicted to porn, it ruined my marriage. They lean in. And they want to know. Because in a world that's Instagrammed and photoshopped and filtered, and they desire authenticity. And everyone in here has had doubts at some point. Everybody in here has had questions that don't seem to have answers. And the more we can lean into that and show that, the better we'll do with this generation.
Okay, so next two are going to be quicker.
Mm-hmm.
One, cheering them on and thinking seriously about what that actually means, not the out of shape lawn chair yelling at them, but making sure they know we believe in them, joining them in the journey, and then making room for doubt, lament, uncertainty. I've watched Derek has actually really influenced my kids, and he and other teachers that are so gifted on campus know how to really make room for students to ask questions by modeling that for them, by actually bringing to light uncertainties about Scripture and our faith, introducing that as just a healthy way of thinking through faith. It does the reverse of what you might fear it would do. My kids love that kind of stuff. It sucks them into, they're interested in the Bible more because of guys like Derek. I get texts from my son, who's a junior, all the time. Hey, Mrs. So-and-so said this. I don't think that's right. What do you think? You know, he's leaning into just like thinking critically, right? Okay, number three is, how did I write this down? I forgot to look at my notes. I got caught up in Derek's. Yeah, I know, but I was. Yeah, okay, so thinking about the younger generation. At the very end of this, I'm going to come back to why we're harping on old people toward young instead of reverse. All right, but thinking about the younger generation like a missionary. All right, so this actually could apply to churches and their communities as well. Most of our churches would fire our church if our church was our church's missionary. That makes sense? Most of our churches would fire themselves if that church was that church's missionary. Because we expect our missionaries to employ all sorts of gospel-sharing strategies to a world that is not like them, right? My brother just returned from Mexico, where he lived for 12 years. The very first thing they did when they moved to Mexico was learn the language. It's just the first thing. Don't go over there and plan to spend very much time without learning the language. Along with learning the language came understanding the culture. It's not okay to be able to speak the language, but not understand the culture in which you are going to minister. Along the way, in those 12 years, they would come to understand things about the culture and drastically change their approach to their communities, from moving from a large building gathering to house churches back to a building. I mean, all sorts of, okay, what's going on in the culture here? What have been their experiences? How do they think about faith? How do they think about God? All those things. We expect our missionaries to ask those questions, but we don't always do a really great job of doing that with generationally, right? And so what happens is then we don't end up with indigenous churches on a generational level, right? I mean, it's the goal, Tim and Kim, Tim's my brother, it's their goal to create, to plant, and help nurture indigenous churches. Churches that thrived on their own, right? That when Tim and Kim walk away, there are Mexican men and women who are taking the charge and leading the church. And so I witnessed this. I will go over and visit them, and I witnessed them. You all did too. I witnessed them stepping back into the shadows, often really pushing the people to whom they were ministering to lead and to sort of carry the banner, and therefore to create an indigenous work. So now that they're not there, they are still receiving stories of conversions and life change, and, right? Because this is what this was their goal. Sometimes we do this well. Sometimes we don't do this very well. Most of the time, I think we mostly just segregate. And so we ask the teenagers to do their things in teenager ways, in teenager places, sort of separate and apart from the body, and therefore do not create very indigenous. Then we complain about their sort of lack, their inability to lead, right? So I'm just asking us, that's all I'm going to say about that, and Derek's going to add a little bit to it, but I'm asking us to think about, go back to your church and think about what it would mean for me to try to plant an indigenous work among the youth in this church. But this is, I'm hoping that they will carry the banner and take over the work here soon. Not much later. Soon. Very soon. Right?
Okay. Yeah, and it is a different culture. It is a different world. It is as much different as going to Mexico. They use different languages. You know, I think one of the biggest cultural differences I've seen in a while, Sweetie, how many of you had a word when you were in high school for like making out with your girlfriend or boyfriend? What do they call it?
Necking.
Okay, necking.
Man, you just aged yourself. Who said that?
So this generation, have you?
Wait, I wanted to know what some of the other words were.
Boogin.
Digging.
This sounds terrible. I don't think I want to know. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So this generation, their word, they use Netflix and chill. Have y'all ever heard this?
Yes.
We're going to go Netflix and chill. Okay? And that means we're going to go watch Netflix and make out in my parents' basement. All right? And so the Mets, they have a minor league team. And the PR lady had heard her daughter using this term a lot. She's like, oh, I like this. And so what she did is they were going to have a Netflix.
But she didn't know what it meant.
She had no idea what it meant. She just thought, my daughter likes Netflix and chill. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to have the Mets Stadium. And we're going to publicize a Netflix and chill night. Bring your family. Right? And this is a banner that they tweeted out. Right? And it's amazing. I had kids streaming it. Did you see what the Mets are doing? Like, Netflix and chilling, right? Bring your family. And so I think what we have to be willing to become students of our culture. In the same way, if we sent a missionary to Mexico and they refuse to learn Spanish, we would fire them, right? And so I spent an inordinate amount of time listening, more than any grown man should listen to Justin Bieber and Beyonce, all right? At the beginning, I kind of hated it, but now I'm like, oh, I kind of like that, right?
I'm judging you right now.
You should. But like, and it goes leaps and bounds. I'll hear something, I'm like, I don't know, what does that mean? Five? Yeah, have y'all ever heard five? This is again, it's one of those words, you know, sometimes in language you have something that's untranslatable. Phi is. And it's the dumbest word in the world, right? It means
cool.
Yeah. And so phi, Mr. Wilson. It's phi. And I'm like, all right. And so it doesn't mean I use it, but it means I'm at least aware of it. And so sometimes I'll be like, as you youth say, that is five, right? And I think we have to become students of our culture and of our language in the same way we would be if we were missionaries. I think also it's about putting young people in leadership and being okay with failure. All our chapels at GAC are entirely student run, and sometimes we put them up there and they crash and burn, and it's 30 minutes of just agony, right?
Which, by the way, I'll just add to that all of the adults mess it up too.
Yes.
So, right, Eli? I'm a minister, and every Sunday I'm a nervous wreck because we have different adults who are participating every Sunday. And I know what I'm going to say. I don't know what any of them are going to say or do. And I know that this Sunday there is at least one person in the room with whom I have one shot. This is it. This is going to be their time to visit a church. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do okay. Sometimes we blow it too. So
yeah.
To act like teenagers are the only ones that blow it or mess it up or say the wrong word or say it the wrong way or are less trustworthy is not very honest about who we are.
Yeah, and in the same way, we're trying to train them up so that when we are gone, they can lead. In the same way we are missionaries, when we are gone, we need them to be able to take over.
But I would just tweak that a little bit and say, before we leave, we want them to lead. This is a weakness on our part, I think, is that, I shouldn't say our, because I don't know you, but we have a hard time stepping back, and we hold on, and we cling to, and I think we probably ought to step back and let go far earlier than what we do. So that's just an opinion, but this whole class is our opinion, so you came to it. So.
And I think exactly that. So I would say learn the language, become a student of the culture, and I would say set them up to lead.
And we got 6 minutes
right,
and two more points.
Yeah, here's my fourth point is, I think in an era where truth is relative, the best story wins. That's how it always works. I'm watching O.J. versus Simpson, and maybe I'll have watched this documentary. The People versus O.J., not O.J. versus Simpson. I was waiting for it to happen, all right? All I remember is that he interrupted my Rockets game. So in a culture where truth is relative, the best story wins. There's this scene in The People versus O.J. It's this kind of documentary / TV show about the O.J. Simpson trial. And in it, it's Chris Darden and Marcia Clark, the two lead prosecutors. And they're sitting in this room. And the defense has just got done telling this amazing story about how the two victims were involved in a Colombian drug ring and Colombian neckties. And I don't know if you remember all this, but it's a fantastic story, right? And Chris Darden is in there, and they're getting creamed. They're just getting murdered, the prosecution is. And he's arguing with Marcia Clark. And Chris Darden says this. He says, Marcia, we're getting killed in there. They're telling a better story. And Marcia responds, she says, yeah, but we have the truth. And I think for so long, our churches have been Marcia Clark. We've said, we have the truth. Doesn't matter how we tell it or in the way we tell it. Because we have the truth. That is no longer the case in postmodernism. We need beautiful stories, and we need to tell them often and tell them well. I think Dusty's church does this really well.
It's also your church.
It's my church. Yeah. True. It's so true. So,
I mean, I own it. But
you do. But they do this really well in that they show videos of things happening at the church, right? And they're really well done and really well put together, and it shows where all these ministries are. And then also the best part of the service is not Dusty speaking by any means.
No.
It's communion. And what we've started doing is at communion, people sit down. There's a family that sits down at a table and tells their story. And so last week it was a dad who, because of a series of poor decisions, ended up in jail. And he talked about how his wife and two daughters loved him through his drug addiction and loved him through prison. That's a beautiful story. Right? Or it's a family. We have a guy that came to Christ under great duress during communist Bosnia.
Bulgaria.
Bulgaria, thank you. It's a beautiful story, right?
Sometimes it's far less dramatic. Right. But there's just beauty in hearing. Each one of you would tell your story. You would think it would be no big deal. But it's beautiful to others because Christ is in it. We've just basically created space for stories to be told at the right place around the communion table.
Right. And so it gives this vision of self-sacrificial love. I think the cross is the most beautiful story there is. It's a person, an innocent man, dying so that other people can have life. And yeah. choosing that willingly. And so that leads perfectly into the last one.
Yeah, but I would add to that, if you haven't read Brian Zond, Z-H-A-N-D?
Z-A-H.
Z-A-H-N. Something like that. Brian Zond. Farewell to Mars, and then Beauty Will Save the World. And Farewell to Mars is his best book, but it'll make some of you mad. But Beauty Will Save the World is about this idea.
Yeah.
It's this whole idea that we have given up, or we've let go of one of our most valuable commodities, and that is we have the best story. It is true, but it is also just flat out the best story. It is a beautiful story. And beauty is what this beautiful story will save the world.
And what Brian would ask, he would say, we need to ask three questions. Is it true? Is it ethical? And then is it beautiful? And for a long time, we focused on only the first two. And now we have to bring back this, is it beautiful? Another great book with this kind of theme is A Million Miles in a Thousand Years by Donald Miller. He talks about his friend Jason was having problems with their daughter. You know, she was caught with weed, and she was dating this boy that was just trouble. And he knew it. And so Jason was like talking to Don. He was like, we're losing our daughter. And so and Don asked, like, what kind of story are you telling with your family? And he realized the story he's telling is not exciting. And so Jason that night gets on the phone, and he researches it, and he buys an orphanage in Mexico just overnight without asking his wife permission or anything. And the next morning, which is not ideal, but he wakes up and he sits his family down and he says, hey, I got news to tell you. We bought an orphanage in Mexico, and we're going to start supporting it and making it work. And like his daughter and his son burst into tears. They're furious because they realize now she might not get that new car. Like they're going to have to make financial obligations. The wife is furious for obvious reasons, right? But he's like, this is what we are doing as a family. And he says after about 2 or 3 weeks of this, after the anger kind of subsided, one night his wife and him are laying in bed, and his daughter, who's 16, comes in and crawls into bed sobbing. And she starts just confessing everything that she's done, some things he didn't even know. And you know, Jason is sobbing and crying, and what he realizes is that he had failed to paint a beautiful story for their life. And that now she, what he realized with his daughter is that she was like almost like they were flipping through a catalog of stories to live with their life. And the one that he had been offering to her wasn't exciting and it wasn't beautiful. And so she had picked something that was exciting, dating a bad boy, you know, doing things. And what he said is, look, now she gets to be a hero in the story. And heroes don't date dirtbags. And heroes don't do drugs because you're a hero. Do it.
I'm going to make a bumper sticker. Right? Okay, we have 1 minute, and the most important one. All right, so we've got five here. And to me, this is the most important one. Jesus did not just come to save you. Or a better way of saying that is salvation is more than just cleansing you of your sins. He came to invite you and me into a way. And that way is cruciform. This whole week is about cruciformity. And if cruciformity is anything, it is those with power surrendering power for others. This is what cruciformity is. This is why there is responsibility on both sides of the generational divide to bridge that gap. But the great weight of responsibility is on you and me. It's on the older, because we are the ones who have more power. We are the ones who have the largest megaphones. We are the ones who have dictated how things will go and what shape they will take. And we are Christ followers. That means you and I, because we love the younger generation, we sacrifice for them. We will be cruciform with them. On one of my most unpopular Sundays at campus, I asked the church, raise your hand if you love hymns. And a number of people raised their hands. And then I said, raise your hand if you hate hymns. And a number of people raised their hands. And I said, raise your hand if you love praise bands. Now everybody's getting red in the neck, you know. And some people raised their hands, some young, some old. And then I said, hey, those of you who love hymns, you know, like when we sing a certain hymn, it takes you to a certain place, right? Because it means something to you. There's a story behind it. Have you noticed that my teenagers and all the other teenagers and the Derricks in the room don't sing very much when we sing the hymns because it doesn't connect with them? And I asked them, what would it mean to you, as mostly older, what would it mean to you if you saw that everyone who just raised their hand and said they don't like the hymns, what would it mean to you if you saw that everyone who raised their hand sang louder when we sang the hymns only because they knew it meant something to you? They don't even know what the words mean, but they're belting it out because they know it means something to you. And just like some of you did, they're all shaking their heads. And then I said, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it because you haven't modeled that for them. You and I have not modeled, oh, that's important to you? Then I will do that even though I don't understand it. Even though it doesn't mean anything to me. Even though I'm not even sure how I feel about it. I will do that because you have said that lifts your spirit. That touches your heart. So you're telling me you like the lights down when we sing? Yes. But don't you want to be able to see around you? And you like the singing or the music louder? But don't you want to be able to hear? We're speaking into what we love. But we are cruciform followers of Jesus. And so we will be glad to say, you know what? We are the ones who have been in the position of power, and therefore cruciformity means for us, we will sacrifice for you. We will gladly do that because we believe love wins. We believe love wins. We believe that the kingdom will grow here if we do that. Guess how popular I was on that Sunday? But didn't I just basically tell the gospel story? You know what was the most common response that I got from people? Well, what about them? Why is it just us? Why are we the only ones that have to let go of our megaphone? And you know what I wanted to say? I didn't say it because I'm not that mean, but I wanted to say, you are preaching my sermon for me. That response is indicative of the problem. Of course, we all have responsibility. Let's just deal with ours, right? Okay, we went over time. Sorry. Those are five things that are sure to make your church grow. That's a lie. I just made that up.
Wow.
Thanks for coming to our class.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.